Welcome back to the Sundance Reel, broadcasting live from Whole Foods today on KPCW. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak.
Chris Cherniak, yes. And we're here for the 8th annual Sundance Reel that we host every year.
I still think you're exaggerating with that 8 years.
All right, 7. Okay, I rounded up. But every year we come here to Whole Foods, and Whole Foods is kind enough to host us here at their cafe, and we have they have a 5% give back day where 5% of their daily proceeds will go to a nonprofit organization or educational institution, and KPCW is honored to be one of the give back recipients. So come on down to Whole Foods today. A portion of your proceeds will go to supporting KPCW. So we really appreciate that. And we've got another hour and a bunch of guests.
That's right.
To talk about.
That's right. In the next hour, we'll be speaking first with Sasha Jenkins, the director of Fresh Dressed. We'll be speaking with Tolga Karachelik, the director of Ivy. Tali Shalom Azir, the director of Princess. And finally, Jimmy Chin and Elizabeth Chai Vassarelli with Maru, the film Maru.
Yeah, that's all coming up this coming hour. And shortly, right after a couple of underwriters, we'll be back. It's the Sundance.
Listen every morning during the 7 o'clock hour for the Nordic Ski Report, brought to you in part by White Pine Touring.
Don't miss hockey legend Luke Robitaille's Celebrity Shootout. Enjoy watching NHL greats and top celebrities as they take to the ice for a great cause. Sunday, January 25th at the Park City Ice Arena. Proceeds to benefit Echoes of Hope, the Robitaille's nonprofit organization dedicated to transforming the lives of young people. Echoes of Hope is a nonprofit organization and proud supporter of KPCW.
Welcome back to the Sundance Reel. And we're back with Sasha Jenkins, the director of Fresh Dressed. The film is described by Sundance as a fascinating, fun-to-watch chronicle of hip-hop, urban fashion, and the hustle that brought oversized pants and graffiti-drenched jackets from Orchard Street to high fashion's catwalks and middle America shopping malls. So, Sasha, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I gave the one-sentence description of your film, but just tell us a little bit what the film's about.
The film is ultimately a back doorway to tell the history and evolution of hip-hop. Fashion has always been an important part of what the culture represented. If you look at, you know, many of the early pioneers of the culture, how they dressed was extremely important. And that importance has not been lost over, you know, the 40 years that hip-hop has been in existence. And it went from something that was very humble and crude with young people creating their own looks. There were no brands that catered to them specifically. So a part of the expression and a part of being an individual, because in hip-hop culture, being an individual is more important than anything else, how you dressed and how you presented yourself was really important. And in the time since, you know, there have been multiple brands created by rappers and other folks who, you know, smartened up and said, hey, no one's really catering to us. Why don't we start making clothing for this audience?
So the name of the film, obviously, is Fresh Dressed.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what that means. Give us a description of fresh.
Well, you know, in the hip-hop world, you know, fresh was a term that was thrown around by young folks in, you know, late 70s, early 80s. It just meant, you know, the notion of something being brand new, fresh out of the box, you know, something that people can see has, you know, for some reason in America, you know, capitalism and poor people, the idea of something new is sort of connected to a monetary value. So mm-hmm. when something is fresh, it is connected to the notion of, you know, money, something new. I had the ability to purchase something. So, I mean, it's not just that, but then it later turned into this notion of looking really nice, looking really clean,
right.
Looking, you know, exceptional.
I like the way the film opens up, where you kind of touched on, it kind of provides a backdrop on the history of dress and the importance of dress as a message
mm-hmm.
Within the community, going all the way back to slavery or so, when you know, this, the concept of the Sunday dress. You look your best.
Yeah, Sunday
always,
best.
The Sunday best. Mm-hmm. And how that kind of evolved from that. Talk a little bit about...
Yeah, I mean, you know, most people listening to this, when you hear someone say, hey, put on your Sunday best, you're thinking, I'm going to look really nice for church or something like that. But during the time of slavery in America, there were certain states where it was mandated that slave masters had to purchase one nice outfit so their slaves can go to church. Now, you know, that's complicated for many reasons, especially when you consider that most of the slaves had their own indigenous religions that came from Africa that had absolutely nothing to do with Christianity. So when you consider that that term still prevails even in the inner cities, this notion of Sunday best, and right. when you think about where it comes from, you know, it's something that a lot of people didn't know and haven't really considered, and hopefully my film will help open some eyes.
No, it did. That was an interesting take on that. And then you say as it evolves. So where's the concept of fresh dress, say, in the 50s and 60s? How does that get started?
Well,
how's it evolved during those decades?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always been a correlation between fashion and music,
yeah.
especially in the African-American community. You know, music is something that is a very deep, personal mode of expression. And oftentimes, you know, how you dressed helped to accentuate that. And again, you know, when you're dealing with folks who are disenfranchised, who don't have much, the notion of keeping up appearances, you know, it's the idea, it's almost totally in tune with this whole sort of Instagram world where people take photos of plates of food or really expensive things and they're smiling, but really what's going on is not what's really going on. What's really going on is you're sad. You know, no one presents an unhappy face on Instagram. And I think when you're dealing with folks in the inner city and people who are poor, no one wants to put on a face of I'm unhappy or I'm suffering. People want to present themselves in a way that makes them feel triumphant.
Yeah, I mean, that some of them talked about they had racks of Polo and Armani and Tommy Hilfiger, but no furniture in their apartment.
Yeah.
You know, that was the dichotomy there.
Yeah.
But it was the street as kind of the street became a catwalk of fashion and style and individualism, like you talked about that.
Well, New York is a city where people ride the subway. You know, it's not like California or other places where you're kind of insulated and you're in your car and you're not interacting with people. So you're on the subway and you're seeing, you know, people from all over the place. And what was interesting that speaks to how times have changed, you know, growing up in New York City, in the 70s, 80s, you could look at someone and based on how they were dressed, this person is from Brooklyn, this person is from Queens. You can tell regionally where people were from, largely because back then, in terms of distribution of clothing, you know, certain manufacturers would deliver certain cuts or certain colorways or whatever in certain regions, in different boroughs. So a lot of it reflected what they had access to.
Right.
But if you flash forward to what's happening now with fashion, because of the internet, you know, everything is, you know, you can order anything from anywhere in the world. You're not limited in terms of your color palette or how you want to dress. You know, the world is a lot more, you know, wide open.
Right.
Sure.
So Park City kids can dress like L.A. urban or New York style.
Or punk rock or anything. You know,
right.
Before you had to be affiliated directly with a subculture. You know, I grew up, I was involved with, you know, hip-hop and graffiti and skateboarding and punk rock at a time when there weren't many people like me who were intimately involved with all of these subcultures. Now, because of the internet and because of the way the world has changed, kids have access to learning a little bit about everything. So now kids are extremely intelligent in terms of having a basic conversation about punk rock or hip-hop or skateboarding. But when I was coming up, how I dressed reflected my dedication to these subcultures and informed who I was and
right.
who I would go on to be. And now it's different.
Yeah.
So was your motivation for making this particular documentary personal, your personal experience with it, or was there something else that kind of sparked this film?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. You know, I was a journalist for many years writing about hip-hop, writing about music in general, published my own magazines, and I felt that, you know, this was a story, you know, the hip-hop story has been told lots of different ways, but this was one way that it hadn't been told. And for me, you know, I moved to New York when I was really young. I moved there in 1977, and my mother told me to go outside and play, and I had a football, and everyone else had magic markers, and they were dancing, and there was music, and I was like, what is this? Right. And all of that stuff that was just an extension of what we did as kids would go on to create this industry where people have made millions and millions and millions and zillions of dollars. Many of those people aren't of the community. So for me, it's a real privilege to be who I am, to have the platform I have to tell these kinds of stories. And other people will tell these stories, but sometimes the nuances that you're going to get from someone who actually is of the culture is going to ultimately do a service to us all in telling. The story's never going to be perfect, but I think the closer we can get to the story is going to come by way of being close to the people who are close to the story.
Yeah, and you interview a number of individuals, obviously, who were both within the style at the times, mm-hmm, as kids, and now are in the fashion world or so, or the entertainment world, and they tell their own. It's a great story.
Thank you.
Yeah, tell us about some of those characters that you talked to.
Well, going back, you know, again, the film starts as far back as slavery and the whole notion of Sunday best, and then it lands in the South Bronx in the 1970s, which, you know, looked like, you know, World War II France, right, or something. You know, there was a great deal of white flight, you know, a lot of arson. The educational system in New York was terrible, and the city was essentially bankrupt, and the South Bronx was just an afterthought. So in this environment, you have this rise of gangs. These gangs were inspired by the Hells Angels and bikers and stuff like that, but because they were of color, they couldn't join these gangs. So then they started creating their own gangs, and how they fashioned themselves or the garments they wore were inspired by what the bikers wore.
Right.
So they essentially looked like bikers. Eventually, there's a gang truce, someone dies, and it leads to the climate on the street changing. So it wasn't really about gangs. It was more about this rise of this cultural movement that would become hip-hop. But they applied this sort of self-stylized, you know, taking what was put on the gang jackets and putting them on sweatshirts. And so it represented their breakdance crew or their graffiti crew, and it was more about, like, cultural expression than sort of this expression of violence. And so then that would lead to, you know, unfortunately, there was a crack epidemic in New,
right,
York City that made a lot of poor people either even way more poor,
right,
or extremely rich. So you have this new class of people who have a lot of money. Who do they look to? Rich folks who are wearing Gucci and Prada and all this,
right,
stuff. So they aspire to buy that stuff. And then all of a sudden, there's this industrious designer in Harlem named Dapper Dan,
yeah,
who takes all of those patterns and makes these very unique sort of looks at what these other folks are making. And as he said, he quote-unquote blackenized it. And,
right,
he made it something that spoke to, you know, the community where he was from. And Dapper Dan has a huge personality. So there are so many people in the film who ultimately were, I liken it to soul food in that, well, what was soul food? Soul food came from the scraps that the slave masters left to the slaves.
Right.
Chitlins, you know, what is that? It's intestines, you know, the stuff no one else wanted. Well, what do? We turn it into an art form. And so hip-hop is a continuum of that attitude of African-Americans being in a situation where they don't have much. These films, these forms of music, they're not made for them. So they look at music and they say, that music's cool, I'm going to make it me. I'm going to sample it, I'm going to insinuate myself, I'm going to add my identity onto these identities that weren't created for me. And I think that ingenuity and do-it-yourself sort of self-starter energy is consistent throughout the film.
We got to wrap up first film here at Sundance?
Yes.
All right.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Lots of luck.
Chris and I were both lucky to see it last night, and we,
yeah,
both loved it.
It's changed your lives. You won't be able to sleep ever again.
Exactly.
Exactly. Look at me. Yeah.
So go get a ticket if you can. It's an awesome film.
Fresh Dress is the name of the film. And its premiere is tomorrow.
Yes.
Tomorrow at the Mark.
Yes.
And it'll be shown three other times during the course of the week.
Wear your Saturday best.
And the Kangol hat and gazelle,
yeah,
shades. Exactly.
Perfect.
Yep.
All right. Sasha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Let's take a break for some underwriters and sponsors. You're listening to KPCW's Sundance Reel live at Whole Foods. We'll be back after this.
Hi, I'm Mitch Martino.
And I'm Marta Mishral. We're from Park City High School.
Stay in touch with all things minors with our weekly Minor Nation Report.
We'll bring it to you every Monday morning during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher.
And in the afternoon with The Local View with Randy Barton.
Highlights, scores, schedules.
All things Park City Minors Athletics.
The Minor Nation Report is brought to you by
UPS Stores,
Rich Fine, Realtor,
and Elliott Work Group.
Go Miners!
This year, it's estimated that 375 million people will be affected by disasters, 50% more in an average year during the last decade. I'm Desi Mattel-Anderson of Field Innovation Team, a key PCW supporter. We're a disaster response nonprofit organization based in Utah. We help communities recover from disasters. We deploy experts in technology, music, design, and more to develop real-time disaster solutions. Volunteer, donate, and learn more at fieldinnovationteam.org.
Welcome back to the Sundance Reel here at Whole Foods. We do this every year. Nell and myself, a two-hour live show from Whole Foods, who are kind enough to give back to KPCW 5% of their daily proceeds. So come on down to Whole Foods here at Kimball Junction, do some shopping, stock up on your food items, and they donate 5% of their
proceeds.
That's
right, 5% giving day is today for KPCW.
And, of course, we have the opportunity to speak to a number of directors of films that are being shown here in Sundance. And right now we're joined by Tolga Karachik. Tolga. He's the director of the film Ivy. It's a film that's in the World Cinema Dramatic Competition. And Tolga, thanks so much for joining us.
No, thank you for having us.
Is this your first time here in Sundance?
Yes. It's
really?
Been actually 2 days only, and I start to love it already.
Already? Yeah. Are you going to be here for a few more?
Yeah, well, I'll be here until the 1st, and my flight was on the 2nd. So.
All right. Well, good. Tell us a little bit about the film.
Sure. Well, the film is basically about, actually, it's a one-location film. The film is taking place in one ship, cargo mm-hmm. ship. So the ship owner goes bankrupt, and five of the crew and the captain has to stay on the ship according to sea safety regulations in a God-forbidden port in Egypt, Anchorage area. They're not allowed to go out. So it's more than 100 days with limited amount of food, and their salary is not being paid. So it's kind of like a psychological thriller between and the power struggle between these five guys who has got nowhere else to go back and no reason to go back to their homes, and this captain who's trying to keep on the hierarchy and the status quo of the ship.
Right, right. Is this based on some real events or kind of stylized on that?
It is
conditions that actually
it
occur.
It is quite a common story that's happening in the shipping world. I've been since I was small. Acquainted to the shipping world, and I traveled a lot to write the script. And while I was writing the script, actually, the same thing was happening in Istanbul. An Italian cargo ship was in a lean, so five people had to stay on the ship. The same story, actually. So it is kind of a tough story that people don't know usually.
Right.
And for me, it also helps me to symbolize actually the status quo that we are all living. And the motto of the film can be summarized as this: the when the ship is not moving, we cannot call it a ship anymore. So what do we do with the captain? So what means do the top of the hierarchy takes to continue the status quo?
Right.
So for me, it's kind of like a microwave of looking at the things happening in the world.
Right.
So these five people are on the ship, and then the dynamics start to change.
Exactly.
So, you know, of course, without giving anything away, what happens?
What happens, first of all, like what happens as you had imagined is happening, because people are starting to hear other people chewing the food more. So it starts from there. And you start hearing small things. You start to get annoyed by other people.
Right.
And so the camps, we call them Turkish camps, the sites have been chosen. And then, of course, the captain has to continue the status quo. So it's kind of like the power struggle amongst all these people. So not to give anything details from the ship, this is how the thing starts building up. It's a movie about building up the tension, actually.
Right, right. So filmed out on location or under the similar conditions? Did you try to recreate actual conditions?
Well, we shot it all in a ship. So it was 3 weeks of shooting. And we had the chance to be over there to rehearse with my actors a lot.
Yeah.
And, well, as you would expect, it's like, on the contrary of what you would expect, the ship is actually such a calming place. If you're just there for 3 weeks, my actors had the chance to fish between the shoots.
Sure.
So
not bad.
I had kind of like difficulty to create that tension amongst
right.
them. But like, it's worked definitely because, well, it's still on an EOD, so it's minus charge all the time, electricity all the time. And really, towards the end of the third week of the shooting, people start to get really tired.
Right.
And the looks in their eyes just had become what I wanted. If I had one more little bit, twice the budget that I had, I would be start shooting after the third week.
Really? Soon you have a documentary on your hands.
Yeah.
There's a whole other film.
Enough with the ship. No, I'm done with the ship
story. Really done with the ship story.
So the entire thing was shot within a 3 week period.
Yes.
How much time did you have planning this film leading up to that?
Well, actually, I looked at my notebooks because I always have notebooks. Like, I have four or five finished already since 2010. And the first time that I had put notes on about this was actually in 2010 when I was shooting Tollbooth, my first feature film. And so I can say that I started writing this in 2010 and it finished 2015, but I... 2014, sorry, and I had finished another script actually during that, which had won some awards, and I was ready to shoot that film, but instead of that, I think just close to the Gezi protest in Turkey, Taksim Square events,
yeah.
I couldn't stop myself of not shooting this film because that was quite between you and me. That was quite my answer to the things that I was feeling at that moment about the status quo and here she tried to keep everything the same as it was.
So, this is your second film?
Yes.
Okay. And this one is in Turkish?
This one is in Turkish.
With subtitles?
With subtitles, of course.
Okay. Is there a difference in trying to direct a film or manufacture a film that is in subtitles versus...
I hate subtitles.
You do? Yes. Okay.
And, well, actually, the more fight I had with the guys who are trying to write the subtitles, translate the film... I had more fights with them than my actors, to be honest.
Okay.
With you. Because for me, the language is rhythm, and all I care about is the rhythm. And my first film was 98 pages, all dialogue, and everyone thought that it was such a silent film. That's the thing that I'm trying to do. If you want to give silence, I think you should only give it by the too much dialogue, because in the life we're talking about nonsense all the time.
Sure.
Which, at the end of the day, you feel like you didn't talk at all. It was a silent day. This is what I'm trying to do with my characters all the time.
Right.
So with this, I had difficulties of translating this, but at the end, I'm happy with the translation because at the end, you're also trying to keep it simple to take the focus on acting also. You don't want people just go there and read like a novel, all the film or all the subtitles.
Right.
So I think I was happy at the end.
Good.
With the subtitles. People will be happy, I think, people will come.
Well... Sundance was happy enough to accept your film.
If Sundance happy, I'm happy.
That's right.
You bet.
Yeah.
All right, the name of the film is Ivy. I'm going to get it. The director is Tolga Karacalik.
Yes.
That's all right.
I'm out. I'm done. Thanks, Tolga, for taking the time to chat. And lots of luck.
Thank you very much.
And when does the film premiere?
It is on the Egyptian Theater starting, I think, 26th.
Monday the 26th,
yeah, and from
9
there
o'clock.
On, I think, 27 on Temple, and you can check out.
Yeah, there's five screenings.
Five screenings total. We'll make sure we catch one.
Yeah, tell me what you think after.
All right, Tolga. Right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Let's take a break for some underwriters. You're listening to the Sundance Reel on KPCW, and we'll be back with more films and directors. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Seth Adams, executive chef of River Horse on Main and a proud sponsor of The Splendid Table on KPCW. Winter is upon us, and we've revamped our menu to complement the cold weather. We offer Sunday brunch, dinner, and après-ski with views overlooking Main Street and live music nightly. 649-3536 or riverhorseparkcity.com.
This is Larry Warren. And I'm Doug Wells, inviting you to listen Monday mornings at 9 after NPR News to Mountain Money, KPCW's show about making money, spending money, and investing it wisely.
You'll hear from local entrepreneurs and national figures, anyone with a good story to tell about how to survive and thrive in the marketplace.
Mountain Money. We'll keep it simple and useful every Monday at 9.
Sponsored by Mountain West Bank, Park City Chamber Bureau, Park City Realty Group, and Jones Waldo Holbrook and McDonough.
Welcome back to the Sundance Reel. We are broadcasting live from Whole Foods today, and you're listening to KPCW Park City. Sitting here with us now are a couple of the folks from the film Princess. We're speaking with the director, Tali Shalom Azer, and Ori Pfeffer, who's one of the lead actors in this film. So welcome.
Thank you very much.
Good morning.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. So give us kind of the overview of this film. You've definitely taken on a really tough subject.
Yes, it is. It's an emotionally tough film. It's about a girl, a 12-year-old girl, that lives with her mom. Her mom is a workaholic, so she stays away from home a lot. So this girl spends most of the time with this guy, with Michael, playing Ori Pfeffer, and he's her stepdad. Mm-hmm. And these guys share a very emotional relationship. They love each other, they're very attached to each other, but this relationship moves into a dangerous territory.
Right. Right.
Fantastic. And so you have kind of three main characters in the film?
Yes, you can say four.
Okay.
Because we have the girl, and there is the mother, the stepdad, and the girl meets Alain, another character, a boy.
Fantastic.
Who looks a lot like the girl,
yeah,
which makes things very...
Yeah, they're almost identical.
Right.
Almost.
I'm just curious, how did you cast that?
It was a challenge.
Yeah.
It took me like a whole year to cast them. I cast the girl, and after that I was looking for the boy, and actually I ran into him in the street.
Okay.
It's unbelievable.
No kidding. So you're out chores one day and you spot this boy.
Exactly.
And that is the girl.
Yeah, I took out... No. First I cast the girl.
But then I met him
and I was like, I took out my iPhone and I told him, listen, you have a twin. I need you for my movie.
What did he think? And his family?
He's not an actor.
Right.
So he said, like, I'm not going to do that. I'm not an actor. I don't want to do that. I'm not interested in films. And then I told him, okay, so just please introduce me to your mother. I want to meet your parents, okay? And then he said, well, fine. And after he read the script, he felt so much attached to this project. He really wanted to do it. And
really?
So how do you work with such young actors in such difficult roles?
Also, with the older actors, it's not very easy.
Right.
You know, because this film really explores sexual dynamic in the family. And it's something that it took us... it was a long process of rehearsals.
Right.
I think something special that Tali did was to get us in a room for about 2-3 months and go back to the basics of doing, like, acting exercises of trust and exploration. And by the time we got to the set, we were like this close-knit family that we had enough trust to cope with the subject and be prepared for it and not to have any, like, you know, issues
sure.
about doing it. But I think the process really enabled us to have the courage to go through with those tough subjects.
Right.
I mean, so fortunate.
And of course, working with non-actors, you know, for them to teach them how to, like, trust and how to explore their own imagination and bring that in and translate it into the work, you know.
Is there a benefit at times with working with a non-actor in this?
I was looking for actors.
Okay.
Like this parts really take a lot.
Yeah.
Like, I need a lot. When I chose Ori, the first thing, I really was looking for an amazing actor. But with the kids, you don't really, there are no too many like experience.
Right. And okay. So limited experience.
It's very psychological. It takes a lot from them to understand what they're doing and to explore that. And I was fortunate enough to get such an amazing and open actors to do that.
In dealing with a subject like this, were there surprises or were there situations where you felt maybe they were going too far, or how do you manage an adult child relationship like this?
You know, funny enough, and that's like, it's almost like apologies that I have to do to Ori, because I was all the time focusing on the girl. She has to feel okay. I have to protect her, and all the time we find, how do you feel now? Is that okay for you? These are the boundaries. We're going to do that.
Right.
You know, in some of the scenes they're dealing with sexuality, it's very technical almost. Like you tell, you're going to do that and that. And Ori, sometimes I just, because he's such an amazing actor, I didn't pay a lot of attention to how he's going through. And I remember in the most difficult scene, I saw him really close to tears, and then I said, oh my God, Ori, I'm so sorry for not thinking about you. You're a man, but still you're a human being.
No, but she's right. You're right. Totally focused on the kids. But she was the kid actor, Sheila Haas, was so incredible in that every single scene she would be like, I'm totally fine. This is because she's a child, and to her it's this experience. She doesn't see the whole thing.
Right.
You know, we see little bits and parts, so we take it on as a game of that specific scene. It's only when you see the movie, you know, start to finish, you get that.
In that full arc.
Yeah.
You begin to see.
She's not a child. Like, she's 17. She was 17 when we shot the film. Yeah, now she's 19.
Okay.
That was also a challenge to find older...
A young-looking. Okay.
Yeah. Teenagers that look, yeah.
She plays a 12-year-old girl.
Yes,
she looks like she's 10 years old.
Okay. In the movie. Yeah.
Okay.
Literally in life, too. You know, she's underdeveloped in a way, but it's just, she's beautiful and all.
Right.
But.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Is she here?
Yeah,
are they all? So who's here in attendance for the film? Is this your first time here?
Here in Sundance, yeah, the first time. So happy and excited to be here.
That's
honestly
fantastic.
Because I love the films that come out from Sundance.
Yeah.
It's for me such an honor. And also, you know, I tell this story not in the traditional way, because I tell the story from internal point of view and also external point of view, and I feel that the audience in Sundance they are open enough for these kind of stories. And
yeah,
so glad.
Yeah, this is the right venue for that, for launching that.
So have you taken on, you know, sort of these tough issues like this before in films? What was your motivation for this specific story?
My previous film also dealt with this kind of sexuality between people. Yeah, I'm very fascinated about sexuality in general.
Fantastic. We have to start wrapping up. I think we're about out of time. But will you be at some of the screenings that are coming out? And tell us when you premiere.
Yeah, I'll be at the screenings, of course, all of us.
Yeah, we're going to be there for Q&A.
Yeah, the actors, the DOP, the producer, the whole team, we're here.
And the premiere is tomorrow?
Yes. Tomorrow at 8:30.
At Prospector Square, and then it'll be shown 4 additional times around the area.
Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic. Well, director Talia Shalom is here, and actor Ori Pfeffer from the film Princess. It's a World Cinema Dramatic Competition entry, and you're first, and that's fantastic.
Thanks.
And we want to know that when we do this, every year we do 5 or 6 guests, and at least 1 or 2 win an award.
All right. We'll take those odds.
I probably just snake bit the whole thing, but we just had to throw
knock
that
on
out
wood.
There. Yeah, so congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having us.
Enjoy Park City.
Thank you.
All right, let's take a break for some underwriters and sponsors. You're listening to KPCW Sundance Reel. We'll be back with one more director, Jimmy Chin and Elizabeth Chai of Asarali, the film Meru. A documentary, fantastic film. It's the Sundance Reel. Stay tuned.
American Roots on KPCW is proudly supported by Donna Van Buren of Greater Park City Properties, managing HOAs in Park City, Canyons, and Deer Valley for 30 years. Greater Park City Properties can be reached at HOA@greaterparkcityproperties.com.
Hello, this is David Brancaccio. Join me for the Marketplace Morning Report at 6:51 and 7:51 a.m. here on KPCW, bringing you the morning business news for the rest of us in the time that takes you to savor your first cup of joe. Marketplace Morning Report is, I think, a useful way to start your day. That's the Marketplace Morning Report, weekday mornings here on 91.9 and 88.1 FM, KPCW.
Brought to you in part by Park City Mountain Resort, Cushman Wakefield Commerce Commercial Real Estate, and Canyons Resort.
We saw the film, too, so we have a lot, so I feel comfortable with. All right, ready? Welcome back to KPCW's Sundance Reel. I'm Chris Cherniak, Nell Larson. We're here interviewing various directors of films entered in the Sundance Festival here at Whole Foods down at Kimball Junction. It's also a Whole Foods 5% Give Back Day. So they give back. They will give 5% of their proceeds go to KPCW. So we thank them for that. That's why we're here. Come on down, do your shopping, buy 8 items, spend $150, and then we get 5%.
That's right. That's good. We also want to thank the Sky Wellness Collection for sponsoring us today here in Whole Foods.
And joining us now is Elizabeth Vassarelli. She is one of the directors of the documentary film Meru. It's in the U.S. documentary competition. Jimmy Chin is another director of the film, and he's a climber. He was in the film, and he'll be joining us shortly. But Elizabeth, thanks so much for taking the time.
It's great to be here, and you can call me Chai.
Chai?
Yes, okay. My middle name that most people call me.
All right.
Yes. Fantastic.
So give us a quick thumbnail sketch of what this film is about.
Well, Meru is a climbing film that's about everything beyond climbing. It's the story of three very close friends who have a dream of attempting the most kind of elusive ascent in the Himalayas, and it's the Shark's Fin on Mount Meru, and it's famous amongst the core climbing community because success has been so elusive. I mean, I've seen more attempts and more failures than any other peak in the Himalayas
by top climbers.
By top climbers, and that's part of our story because. Jimmy's mentor is Conrad Anker, and Conrad is featured quite centrally in the film. And Conrad's mentor was Muggs Stump, and this was Muggs' big dream. So it became, and Muggs attempted it 3 times and failed, and it became Conrad's obsession to make it to the top of Meru. So the film follows that as Jimmy
their
Renan
attempts
yes.
To complete this climb and the challenges both externally and internally they have in trying to achieve this. And Jimmy Chin joins us now.
Yes, he does.
Last minute.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us, Jimmy.
Yes.
We'll get your mic on in a second. So we got a real quick thumbnail sketch of what the film is about. Jimmy, you were one of the climbers, though.
Yes.
Of the three. Why this mountain?
Well, this mountain's significant for a number of reasons, personal, but also within the climbing community. We almost think of it as the anti-Everest because Everest is this mountain that, you know, if you're a climber, everybody says, have you climbed Everest? You know, but nobody knows about Meru, you know. And but Meru is considered to be one of the most difficult, this route on the Shark's Fin on Mount Meru is considered to be the most difficult route in the Himalayas. And the way we, you know, the community kind of decides that is by looking at how many people have attempted it and who's attempted it. You know, very, very strong teams have attempted it and had seen more attempts and failures than any other route in the Himalayas. So it had this kind of cachet for being.
And why is that? What makes this mountain so different?
Well,
What is the elevation? Elevation is anything.
Yeah, the elevation certainly isn't the tallest mountain in the world, but it's the reason it's the most challenging. It's well over 21,000 feet, and it's challenging because of all the technical climbing aspects of it. And so it requires a high level of climbing in, you know, snow, ice, mixed rock climbing, and then big wall climbing. If you follow the Dawn Wall on, yeah, on El Cap,
we just mentioned that.
You know, it's akin to putting El Cap on Denali. You know, and so there's the factors of altitude and cold.
Right.
So how does filming something like this change the experience of climbing it? I was thinking that as I watched the film, you know, would anything be different if you didn't have a camera there in the background?
Yeah.
Aside from carrying all that weight up the mountainside.
Yeah. Well, personally, I guess filming and shooting have kind of evolved and grown along in parallel with my climbing. So, you know, it's something I've been doing for 15 years, and it's kind of what I specialize in. And Renan also, you know, is a filmmaker that shoots climbing and expeditions. So both of us have experience doing that, and it's part of, you know, what we do in both climbing and filming and shooting are, you know, things
second
that we're very
nature,
passionate and we're passionate about.
Right.
Yeah.
And then another thing is about this climb is that you have to lug all your equipment up. There's no assistance. There's no Sherpas. You're dragging up all this equipment, and then you're portaledging night,
yes,
after night after night. So talk about what that's like. I mean, just to see you guys portaledging, that to me is,
yeah,
kind of
so,
crazy enough, but you just get comfortable with that, too.
Yeah, maybe just to clarify for the audience, the portaledge is basically like a hanging cot with a tent over it. And the terrain on Meru is too steep to, like, dig out, like, a platform,
right,
for a normal tent. So you have, like, these hanging tents, which are called portaledges. And we had a portaledge that the three of us would sleep in at night. You know, big task. One of the challenges of the mountain is that the big wall is at the top of this route. So big wall climbing requires a lot of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue, of course, was to haul all of that equipment up the mountain climb just to get to the wall. And certainly hauling equipment and climbing in that terrain made it really challenging, and is very likely why it hadn't seen an ascent before.
Right. And at one point, you're stuck in the portaledge for days and days.
Yes, we were stuck in the portaledge for... there was one time we were stuck in a storm for almost 5 days, 4.5 days.
And of course, during that time, you're consuming food and fuel, and you're running out of it. And so I don't want to give away too much of the,
yeah,
the film.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
Is that all right? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But
they almost starved to death.
Really?
Not
exactly.
They're just very hungry.
I mean, ultimately, yeah, that plays in your decision. You may have the energy, the desire, the motivation, the route, the conditions, but you may not have enough food or fuel. There's so many elements that go into trying,
sure,
to
accomplish. I mean, there's definitely a calculus to it, and that, you know, we are professionals at taking calculated risks and, like, managing risk and assessing risk. And, you know, there are these different lines that you draw when you do a climb like that, and you're very aware of what lines you're crossing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you take in all of the information and the, you know, and make a decision. And the thing is, it's just to return to the why Meru is significant. This is a climb that Conrad, my mentor,
right,
had tried multiple times. It was kind of a 25-year obsession for him because it was his mentor's dream as well. So he had a lot of skin in the game. And when you have that kind of skin in the game, you have to be really careful about your decisions, because you have to be extra careful about your decisions.
Sure.
You know.
In looking back at this, do you ever think, like, are you ever surprised at the decisions that you made? Do you think those are decisions you would make again? And I ask that because I think, you know, at the beginning, Chai said something like, well, this is like a climbing story, but it's about everything kind of around climbing, and you guys think and talk about so many big issues like mortality and family relationships and how does this interact, and so I think that plays into the decisions as well. And I was interested about what you were thinking through when you made those calculated, you know, decisions.
You know, I think it's, you're kind of being bombarded constantly with difficult decisions, and there's, you know, sometimes the decisions are obvious, but sometimes less so. when the risks are very high and the stakes are very high, you know, you have to examine really what your intentions are. You need to kind of be aware of where you're, how much of it is being driven by what different things, like your, you know, your ego or your friendships or your loyalties or your obsessions. You know, you do, you know, when the stakes are that high, it's an interesting place to be because you are hyper, you have to be hyper conscious of like your intentions.
Right. But yet, your goal at one point was literally just hundreds of feet away and you make the decision to stop.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really fascinates me. It's like, where do you find the clarity and the focus there to say, we're done as a climber? Because, and you know, like, it's not like we can come back next week or, you know, next month or so. But yet, it's from there to the cheese section.
Sure.
You know,
yeah, yeah.
How do you make that call?
You know, I think John Krakauer, who's part of the film, sums it up very well. You know, in climbing, it's about taking it as close to that line without crossing it. And when you do this for a lot of years, you're very aware of, like I was talking about, these little lines that you cross. Like, okay, now we're in, like, like a red zone of risk, you know? And then there's, like, another line, and, you know, you are very conscious of when things are out of your control. And sometimes you have to give that, you know, sense of control up, but, you know, there's a point on the mountain where it becomes obvious and you say, okay, we have pushed beyond all of these lines and this is a line we can't cross. And we already had 1 foot over it, you know, so.
But this has to be a group decision too.
Yeah,
and
it does.
That can also create a tension.
That comes down to your history with your partners and the trust. And, you know, it becomes a very, when you can climb with a partner and make decisions with them in a place where it becomes egoless, that's like the partner you want to be climbing with,
right.
You know, and our friendship and Renan, you know, being our friend as well. Like, I mean, you become so tight on these types of climbs that you finish sentences for each other sometimes.
Right.
So, you know, if it's a really good team, you can kind of come to those conclusions.
And actually, one other thing, that's what I noticed is that you become one, you're in effect one climber. You know, the three of you are one.
Yes, everything is, you know, put towards the same goal.
Right.
You know.
So you have to think.
Yeah, it's actually a beautiful thing. I mean, that's what part of the appeal of going on really challenging expeditions is, you know, coming up with a team that can function at a really high level in these, like, very, very, you know, high-risk, high-stakes situations.
Is climbing at 20,000 feet a problem with communication and thought processes, lack of air? You did this with on...
Sure. I mean, in terms of altitude, yeah. You know, by the time you're at 20,000 feet, you're definitely feeling it.
Yeah.
If you spend a lot of time at altitude over multiple seasons, you know, and you acclimatize correctly, you can function fairly well. You breathe pretty heavily.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, like, what kind of physical shape are you in when you finish this, you know, these expeditions? You've been out there for weeks, you know, freezing, wet, exhausted.
Sure. Well, you come out, it's amazing how your body adapts on expeditions. Your metabolism does this thing where, because on expeditions, it's all about hyper efficiency. And that's why, like, planning and every aspect of every day is about doing it as efficiently as possible, and it actually manifests in your body. And so it's interesting. You come off of an expedition, and your body is, you know, is usually emaciated, and you've lost 20 pounds. But you come back down to sea level. It's really, I've actually come back from high altitude expeditions where I didn't even need to sleep as much for like a week. I don't know if that's proven in some scientific physiological study, but that's my experience. And, you know, you eat very little food and your body is able to, like, metabolize it in a way that's hyper-efficient. So,
if you just joined us, we're speaking with Jimmy Chin and Elizabeth Chai Vassarelli. They're directors of the documentary Meru. It's in the U.S. documentary competition. It has its premiere tonight.
Yeah.
At the Temple Theater at 9 o'clock. Well, Nell and I were fortunate enough to see the film.
Oh, you did.
It's fantastic.
Okay,
I can't recommend it enough. And one of the things, I mean, the images are fantastic. I mean, that's
all of the
itself.
Incredible content,
you know,
aside
what,
just the scenery.
You know what I really
impressive.
Liked about is just kind of the soundtrack, too, in a sense that lots of times there's a lack of it. And because you watch these documentaries and there's always the directors feel this need to have some type of music underlying some strings here or there. But many times all you did was play the audio of what you guys were doing. Metal on rock, metal on metal, you guys talking to each other, you're breathing. That's the soundtrack to me. I really like that. I don't know if that was intentional, but I just love that. I wish more documentaries just play the soundtrack of what's going on.
Yeah, I'm sure Chai can speak about
it. No, we felt that it would add to the immediacy of the experience.
Yeah.
And one of the incredible things about shooting on a mountain like that is it is so quiet.
Yeah. And that's part of the soundtrack, too.
It's so quiet. It allows us to really hear the activity and bring the immediacy of the experience, like a presence for the audience.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, Chai, tell us about your role in this. You know, you weren't actually up there on the mountain on this expedition.
Thank God.
So, you know, they come back, and are you looking at the raw film? You know, what's your role, and what's your perspective
on
it?
My role was to bring some objectivity and exteriority to the story. I mean, the story has all the, like, irresistible elements of a great documentary film. You know, it has the drama, it has the challenges, it has these remarkable characters.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was interested in developing that and helping them open up the story so that people who may not be so familiar with climbing could get a sense of really the experience, like the visceral experience of these elite climbers and what it means to pursue your passions and your dreams with such ferocity. And also that, you know, while the scale is big and overwhelming, like this mountain's large, tall, you know, cold, but it's very sophisticated what these guys are doing, and the decisions they're making are personal decisions. So at its core, Meru is a personal story.
Yeah.
And one that I think that, you know, yes, there are life and death, real life stakes, but we can all kind of empathize in some level with the strength of that friendship and make us think about what we're doing with our lives. You know?
Yeah, it's a great film. And listen, it's not a simple film, a climbing film, we're going to do that. No, there's a lot of twists and turns. You talked about risk and reward. And then there's some level of tragedy that it wasn't even a function of risk. You know, and that's part of, I guess, climbing and extreme sports, that you could take all the process all the challenges and risks and get it down and still make bad decisions. Or things can still happen to you unexpectedly.
Yeah.
And that happens in the film.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then how you recover from that.
That was definitely a goal to do that.
Yeah. Well, it's a great film. The name of the film is Meru. we had Jimmy Chin, one of the climbers. Oh, Jimmy, I got to get your thoughts real quick. Your thoughts on the Dawn Wall?
Oh, yeah. Tommy and Kevin are good friends of mine. I just hung out with Kevin. You know, I thought it was just incredible, the momentum in media that, you know, it picked up. And I think it's doing some incredible things for the climbing community and raising the awareness of kind of like the beauty and the challenge and like, you know, the passion involved in this sport that hasn't really seen as much attention before.
Yeah, you know it's getting big attention when you see, you know, President Obama posting about it on Instagram.
Cool. Front page of the New York Times.
Yeah.
All right, Jimmy Chin and Chai Vassarelli, directors of Meru, thanks so much for joining us. Great film. I recommend it. It's getting its premiere tonight at the Temple Theater, and it's, of course, being going to be shown 4 or 5 more times during the week. Thanks a lot. We got to wrap up. We got to cut out. Thanks again for joining us, the KPCW Sundance Reel.
That's right, sponsored in part by the Sky Wellness Collection and Whole Foods.
Remember, this is KPCW Park City. NPR News is next.
KPCW keeps you informed during the day with our noon news report. News, weather, and information with Leslie Thatcher, Lynn Ware Peak, and Rick Bruff. Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you in part by Heidi Gatch, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, HeidiGatch.com.
Additional funding for news and information on KPCW has been provided by University of Utah Healthcare, located at Redstone, 435-658-9200, redstone.uofuhealth.org. Peak Art and Frame, custom frames, mirrors, shadow boxes, art, 435-649-0801. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.